Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and as a listener of Intelligent Medicine, you can try a bottle of their finest artisanal olive oil, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. I've been enjoying these harvest fresh olive oils for years. They are far and away the brightest, most lively, and flavorful olive oils I've ever tasted. Their antioxidants and polyphenols are off the charts because they're fresh from the harvest. They make store-bought olive oils taste dull and flat by comparison. Taste for yourself. Check out this generous trial offer and get your $39 bottle for a buck with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. Myfavoriteoliveoil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Today, a discussion about irritable bowel syndrome with the author of The Digestive Health Solution. He's Dr. Benjamin Brown. He's an Australian naturopathic physician who now resides in the UK, contributing editor to Integrative Healthcare and Applied Nutrition, Recently, Benjamin, you wrote an article about fibromyalgia, which has a link to irritable bowel syndrome, because the criteria for fibromyalgia, of course, tender trigger points, achy body, fatigue, depression, but also a high prevalence of IBS. Is there a connection, and could strategies that alleviate IBS impact fibromyalgia?
Yeah, it's such a great question. You know, one of the shortfalls of medicine in general is we compartmentalize things, and often the, you know, possibility that there's a link between one area of the body and another, or one set of symptoms and another, is not made. But, you know, as you know, the body's a network of systems that are constantly interacting, and everything, you know, is connected. And it seems reasonable then, with that in mind, that there would be some physiological connections between something like IBS and fibromyalgia. And in fact, when you look at the statistical prevalence of the two, they cluster together frequently. There's a very high prevalence of these things overlapping. And so it's not by chance. And it seems that there are some shared mechanisms and pathways. And the most obvious one is this heightened sensitivity to pain. You know, this is the characteristic symptom of fibromyalgia, is diffuse pain throughout the body. And what is irritable bowel syndrome? Well, that's also heightened sensitivity in the gut and the experience of pain. So physiologically,
like a visceral hypersensitivity, like more people with IBS seem to be more attuned to what's happening in their stomachs. You know, like right now, you know, you ask me, like, how's your stomach? Oh, fine. You know, I'm not really attuned to it. And I'm not, but, you know, the rumbling, the grumbling, the peristalt, it's almost like they feel every little, contraction, or peristalsis of their, GI tract.
Exactly. And visceral hypersensitivity is exactly what it is. It's this scientific term for heightened pain sensitivity and poor feedback and ability to shut that response down. Mm-hmm. So people are in this heightened state of physiological sensitivity to pain. And there have been suggestions for many years that there are connections between the gut and the experience of fibromyalgia. And as our understanding of the microbiome is becoming more sophisticated, we're starting to see those links between certain gut microbes and the experience of fibromyalgia. So there really is an important overlap there. But
Dr. Alessio Fasano once so eloquently said, what happens in the gut doesn't stay in the gut.
Yeah, exactly.
Paraphrasing the Las Vegas promotion.
Exactly.
So, you know, that there's systemic manifestations of GI imbalance, leaky gut or the vagus nerve, you know, all these things, you know, there's a gut-brain highway.
There certainly is. And, you know, so that's what's happening. So getting back to your fundamental question is, would treatment or dietary therapies overlap and benefit both? They certainly do. And a classic example of that is actually the low FODMAP diet. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't aware of this until conducting this review for this article recently, but there is a clinical trial of the low FODMAP diet, which was developed to alleviate IBS in patients with fibromyalgia. And guess what happened? Well, their IBS symptoms reduced. You would expect that. But curiously, their diffuse musculoskeletal pain throughout their body was also significantly reduced as well. So there's an example right there of you know, diet hitting different targets and systems across the body with a single intervention. It's pretty amazing.
You know, we say that the IBS is not a psychological condition, but certainly there's some studies that suggest that things like hypnosis or cognitive behavioral therapy can be helpful. So we don't want to completely preclude a psychological approach or a stress reduction approach in dealing with IBS patients. So talk to us about that.
Yeah, that's a very powerful point, actually. And, you know, the discussion earlier we had about it not being all in your head is not entirely true, and that the brain and the nervous system are intimately involved in gastrointestinal function. And it's clear that gut dysfunction can precede, meaning it almost predicts the development of things like depression and anxiety. And we see this in the, you know, in the IBS research. And what that means then is that the gut, brain, and nervous system are interlinked and involved in this whole process. So the way I think about it is, you know, when you've down the track of you've developed IBS and you're experiencing anxiety and depression and stress alongside your gastrointestinal symptoms, you have an opportunity there, in fact, to use mind-body therapies to help calm down the gut. You know, so it's another therapeutic avenue or approach. And, you know, as you put it, it's not suggesting that it's all in your head. It's just another component of your body that's involved that we can address that will really help. And things like mind-body therapies, relaxation techniques, and other interventions can be really powerful for some people.
Well, we've given a nod to CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, while we're playing alphabet soup here. What about CBD, cannabidiol? Because for some patients, they report relief with hemp-derived cannabinoids, or even, you know, with a little THC added, because stateside, we're seeing more and more states that are legalizing medical marijuana. And for gastrointestinal conditions, there may be some applicability.
Yeah, it's such a fascinating area that's in its infancy to a degree, but evolving very quickly. And it is quite clear that these high CBD extracts of hemp do have anti-stress, anti-anxiety, mood-enhancing, as well as pain-relieving type effects.
Perhaps also a little anti-inflammatory effect too, because of all the components, the entourage components of cannabidiol.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're absolutely
terpenes
right.
Terpenes and so on.
Yeah, the effects throughout physiology are just remarkable. So it's, you know, it's likely working on multiple systems. And, you know, I certainly feel like it's worth trialing, you know, if the picture fits and you think you might respond to that.
So what about some herbal therapies? I mean, your background is in naturopathic medicine. I mean, there's a really long and rich tradition in naturopathic medicine using herbals. You know, this whole category of medications used to soothe the stomach, carminatives and things like that.
Yeah, it's very true. And I mean, it you know, when you look at the history of herbal medicine, it looks like people have been self-medicating for digestive problems since the beginning of time. And there are a lot of herbs across different cultures that have been used traditionally, but there are also quite a few that have been really well scientifically studied now for IBS. And probably the best example is just peppermint oil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking of that.
Yeah. So enteric-coated or delayed-release peppermint oil's undergone loads of clinical trials. From my last count, it was over 20, I think.
It's a drug in England, right? Colpermin is still the name of the medicinal that's used in England.
It is, in fact, yeah. It's well spotted. It's sold as a medicine for IBS, and it has approved health claims. Yeah, it's great. You know, it's a non-drug therapy. It works very well. It's in part because it's antispasmodic, and possibly in part because it's changing the gut microbiome a bit.
It's a
well.
Little bit it's, antimicrobial. It suppresses the right. growth of bacteria. So yeah, dual action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, other things that have worked very well for acute symptom relief are peppermint, but also fennel oil and other antispasmodic, carminative type herbs that are really designed to do exactly that, is just calm down that spasm and discomfort and pain. One that I find really interesting, I don't know if you've seen this, but in the last couple of years, there's been a bit of work done on Boswellia serrata for irritable bowel syndrome, and that seems to be really effective. It's working as well as antispasmodic type drugs for pain relief and symptom relief. And there was recently a 12-month follow-up study on this herb, and they found that it was able to keep IBS in remission in the people that were responding well initially as well. So a really interesting substance. And the way Boswellia is working, of course, is, well, partly herbs have multitudes of actions, but it's a strong anti-inflammatory. Mm-hmm. So it could be well suited to people that have that.
How about berberine for diarrhea predominant IBS? Is any utility there?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a great clinical trial on that, and certainly works very well. It has, of course, been shown to treat diarrhea in other settings. So, you know, diarrhea predominant IBS is really problematic for people, and any therapy that, you know, is effective is certainly worth knowing about. Berberine is one, and glutamine, interestingly, is another that could be trialed.
Right. Glutamine with some spotty, I mean, it's sort of controversial whether it's helpful in ulcerative colitis, but it, you know, it's theoretically, it could be a benefit because it is literally a food for the enterocytes, the cells that line our intestinal lining, and may have a reparative effect on leaky gut or damaged intestinal mucosa.
Absolutely. And you're right. The work in inflammatory bowel disease is quite mixed, but there was a small, you know, singular study done in a group of patients with IBS relatively recently on glutamine. And this all came about because the scientists originally were looking at the cellular sort of function of the gut in IBS patients, and found that those patients who'd previously had an infection while traveling, like and developed post-infectious IBS, they had a defect in glutamine metabolism.
Yes,
in their gut.
Yes,
right.
I saw that.
So they thought, well, let's give them glutamine, and it worked, you know, really well for them. So it's certainly worth trialing, and I think something that fits that picture of, you know, I've never been right since, and I've got diarrhea predominant symptoms since I was traveling. You know, it could be quite useful.
There's also, you know, perhaps a subtype of IBS that may be related to pancreatic insufficiency, inability to produce exocrine pancreatic enzymes. How do you spot that? Is it a matter of trial and error? Give people digestive enzymes, amylase and proteases, and, you know, just or lipases, and see if they're better?
Yeah, it's, you know, digestive enzymes are really interesting therapy, and it's, there are different ways you can personalize them, but getting back to your point is that certainly there is a subgroup of people with IBS-like symptoms who have poor output of enzymes, and they're just not making enough. And there are a few research groups that have looked at this, and they've generally found it's about 5 to 7% of IBS patients. So it doesn't sound huge, but when you know, there's a lot of people. And what happens is when you identify this using a test called a fecal elastase 1 test, which you're very familiar with, and that doctors can organize. You then do is personalize enzyme therapy to people who are a bit low, and that can be a really effective way to identify it, manage it, and result in really good clinical improvements. But of course, enzymes work in other ways as well. As you know, they help you break down food. They help, and as a consequence, could potentially help with food intolerances as well. So breaking things down like fibers even, and lactose and foods, so they're less allergenic, so to speak, as well. And, you know, it's hard to know who's going to benefit, but certainly it's a pretty cheap clinical trial if you just try digestive enzymes. If the, you know, symptoms tend to indicate it might be beneficial for you, it's a simple way to test. But, you know, I think a caveat to that is there's a lot of variation in the quality of products on the market. So speaking to someone who knows what they're talking about to get a good product is a good idea, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it has to be of the right potency, but different strokes for different folks. Some people actually experience discomfort with those because in addition to breaking down food, they also act as signaling molecules that sometimes trigger peristalsis or diarrhea, so gotta be careful.
Absolutely. That's a great point.
Yeah. Are we missing any major modalities here in terms of our armamentarium of approaches for IBS?
We've covered a lot of ground, actually, and I think hit a lot of the key areas. I mean, beyond gluten, I guess there are other potential food sensitivities. One that's broadly sort of interesting is this immunologically mediated hypersensitivities. And, I think we spoke about this previously a bit, but looking out for foods that aren't really obvious that may be identified on an elimination rechallenge or using something like a food sensitivity test could be useful for some patients, mm-hmm. it seems.
And how accurate are those tests? Because I got to say, first of all, regulatory in the U.S. is really cracking down on some of the tests that we used to have available to us. But I'm actually not too dismayed because those tests, they're not deadly accurate. The IgG RAST or, some of the tests that are, cytotoxic testing, it's sometimes a little bit like throwing darts at a dartboard. You might just try an elimination diet without expensive testing.
I'm with you. I think an elimination rechallenge diet's the way to go. And to answer that question, it's a minefield out there in terms of the quality of the tests and their validation. Mm-hmm. Probably the best validator is the basic IgG test, and the accuracy of that is not great, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. It sometimes gives you something to hand to a patient and say, well, look here, this says you're sensitive to this, this, and this. If you need the documentation, if that's the way your patient works, if they're very wonky, okay, here's the test. The test says eliminate, probably going to hit on the major foods that the person eats all the time. Wheat, dairy, corn, nuts, et cetera. And, that test really nailed it. Well, it actually describes the foods that you basically subsist on because your immune system recognizes them and they show up in your, as antibodies.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what's happening. And you're totally right. Like when you look at these food sensitivity tests, they're flagging up the same things time and time again. So a basic elimination rechallenge diet will tend to weed those things out anyway.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, I know one paradigm that we kind of sidestepped that I want to talk about, and it's a very interesting, relatively new paradigm. I don't think we talked about it the last time we spoke. Is histamine, okay?
Yeah.
And so,
cool.
Can you introduce us to that concept? Histamine intolerance. What's that about?
Yeah, it's such an interesting area in the field of nutrition and food sensitivities, and it has a fascinating history, and that is that it has been pretty well established as a concept through Eastern Europe and Russia, and was practiced and talked about and researched a lot, but in foreign languages. So it really didn't start to break into Western medicine until things started getting translated, and then people have picked it up and started studying it. But what it essentially is that it appears histamine is a substance that can occur in foods, and it can provoke a kind of allergic type response. In fact, it's something your white blood cells make when you have allergies. It's the mm-hmm. same stuff. And it appears that some people have an intolerance to it in foods. So it's not necessarily the food that's the problem. It's that you're not handling the histamine very well. Mm-hmm. And it appears to be a combination of overexposure, but probably inability to break it down.
Your histamine cup runneth over, so to speak. It's
exactly.
Like your capacity may be lower than other people to withstand a histamine challenge, a minor challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. And it really is emerging as an important phenomenon, I think, and certainly one worth exploring. The thing with histamine intolerance is the symptoms are generally fairly characteristic and would push you in that direction of investigation, because they do start, you know, tend to mimic allergic type symptoms. So they, you know, you may get IBS symptoms, but they'll often co-present with a rash or allergic type symptoms, or even asthma type
hives,
symptoms.
Migraines. Exactly. Right. Sometimes, you know, bodily malaise that doesn't appear to be a classic allergic response.
Exactly. Yeah, that's absolutely it. So, you know, in terms of therapeutic options, a low histamine diet can be effective, and you can also use histamine metabolizing enzymes as a supplement, which may have
diamine oxidase products. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, so there may be some benefit to those also.
And you know, where this paradigm really comes in handy is when people are very confused. They come in and they say, "I mean, I can't tell you. Sometimes I eat a food and I'm fine, and then, you know, I just can't pin it down. My symptoms just keep, it's almost like they're allergic to food across the board. And they may say, well, I really have trouble with balsamic vinegar. Okay, that's a classic trigger, or aged meats or something. These are classic triggers, but sometimes it's just very elusive, and it's not the typical allergens that we mentioned earlier, you know, the things that people are sensitive to, like wheat or dairy. I've tried to eliminate wheat, dairy, you know, the basic things. I still have these weird breakthrough symptoms, and then we can go to the histamine paradigm and figure it out.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a really good example of some of the things you can start to pick out when other things aren't working, and histamine is one of those. And another one I'd add to that actually is this, which I think is, you know, very preliminary, so it's hard to hang your hat on this one, but a sensitivity to nickel. And you know, it's been known for many years that people can have dermatological reactions to nickel-containing jewelry. Mm-hmm. So they have a kind of sensitivity.
Earrings and so on,
Exactly.
Bracelets.
Yeah, right. So a very sort of progressive group of gastroenterologists in Italy, they are, you know, one of the world's leading research groups as well. They're not an alternative bunch. And they decided to put two and two together and said, well, you know, we also know that people who have allergy to nickel jewelry, they sometimes get IBS-like symptoms. So could nickel in food be contributing to IBS? So they got an assay of the nickel content of various foods, devised a low nickel diet.
Wow.
And then they got a bunch of people with IBS and did scratch tests for nickel sensitivity.
Yeah.
Subtype them into the ones who were reacting to nickel on the skin, put them on the low nickel diet, and just had a phenomenal clinical response.
What foods are high nickel?
I actually don't have the list to hand, but
the list is somewhere. Yeah, Google it.
It is. Yeah, and it's one of the interesting things is that there are a lot of common foods that people wouldn't otherwise associate with causing IBS. Oats is one of them. Mm. Chocolate is another.
I would be in trouble.
Yeah, me too. And that's like my diet right there. And certainly certain nuts as well. And that, you know, what made me think of it is your comment is that when you're not exactly sure what's going on and it feels like they're just reacting to foods with no particular reason, nickel is something to look out for.
Right. But, you know, more generally, aren't there a lot of ingredients in ultra-processed foods that can be problematic? I mean, just to, keeping it simple, people should, you know, get off ultra-processed foods, you know, the emulsifiers, the preservatives, the colorings, all these chemicals and possibly even glyphosate and pesticide residues. These are things that can have a harmful effect on the gut.
Yeah, that right there is the elephant in the room. You know, we've been talking about very specific, sometimes very restrictive diets. It's crazy to me that no one in the IBS research is talking about what you just said. It's happening a bit in the inflammatory bowel disease area. We know now that ultra-processed foods and additives and pesticides and all that stuff we're exposed to in the diet is a really significant factor. So why are we not talking about this with IBS? So it's you know, bringing it back to just cleaning up the diet, reducing exposure to processed foods, additives, chemicals, going more organic where possible, I think would have a huge effect. But it's something so blindingly simple, but it's just being overlooked.
Yeah, rather than looking for esoteric solutions. All right, well, look, we've covered a lot of ground. There's a lot of information out there. Can our listeners access any of your articles? I mean, certainly your book, The Digestive Health Solution, I think there's a second edition. It's been revised since you originally put it out a couple of years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. That's now in a second edition, so readers can look that up. And in terms of research, there's a paper which was published in July this year in the journal Gastrointestinal Disorders titled, Does Irritable Bowel Syndrome Exist? Identifiable and Treatable Causes of Associated Symptoms Suggest It May Not. So that's worth looking up too. That's open access. So it's
you're saying that it's the point that that's kind of a clickbait title in a way, because it's like you're asking this question is, and the I think the underlying point is it one monolithic condition, or is it just a series of subtypes of conditions, each of which is amenable to a unique strategy rather than some overarching, you know, okay, take antispasmodics, take antidepressants, you know, the way we handle it now.
Right. And, you know, this
it's a great article. And for our, you know, our wonkier listeners who want to do a deeper dive, look that one up. Where can they find it?
Yeah. So that's in Gastrointestinal Disorders. If you just punch in that term, it'll come up, and it's also available on PubMed and Medline for the nerdy people who are listening.
Right.
So it's but it's exactly as you put, like, we need to start thinking integratively. You know, it's lazy to just subgroup people into a name for a disease and start treating them symptomatically. As we've just discussed, there are lots of identifiable and manageable causes that could explain why people have symptoms.
Well, great stuff, and, you know, congratulations on a really wonderful career with a focus on not just on irritable bowel syndrome, but, you know, its relationship and, you know, to a wide variety of bodily problems, fibromyalgia syndrome, and, you know, on and on it goes, because the gut is really central to our health, and optimizing its function can yield a lot of benefits and a lot of related areas.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's, you know, I'm a great admirer of your work, and, you know, you're getting this message out there that, you know, better quality healthcare is the way forward. And, you know, it's a real honor to be able to speak with you about this.
Well, it's my great pleasure, and we'll reprise this sometime soon. Dr. Benjamin Brown, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And good night to you folks in the UK. Because it's late by you, right?
It is, yeah.
It's about 6 hours later. Okay, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thank you. It was really great.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Hi, this is Dr. Ronald Hoffman. As we age, forestalling and even reversing bone loss becomes more and more important. That's why I've created the Intelligent Medicine Bone Health Protocol, my personal supplement recommendations to ensure your skeletal health. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com. In addition to the Bone Health Protocol, you'll find easy-to-follow links from my Supplement Starter Kit, Heart Health Protocol, and much more. These new protocols are an easy way for you to get the exact combination of targeted supplements you need to help you follow the intelligent medicine lifestyle, and for a limited time, you'll get free shipping on all of your store orders. For more details, just go to DearHoffmanStore.com. That's DRHoffmanStore.com.